was not by any means as keen on the idea of welcoming the president of the great imperialist country in the way that her husband eventually was. And the violence of those views and of the society which had sort of produced the situation, I think, is very audible in the way that Adams has orchestrated that part of the opera.
It's very interesting, isn't it? There are two main roles for women, and they're so contrasted. Pat Nixon and Madame Mao. I don't think you could get women who are kind of more poles apart, really. I mean, tell me a little bit about Pat Nixon. She turned up stepping out of the plane wearing a scarlet red coat, even though she'd been primed that only prostitutes in China wore red. Was she politically naive?
Well, yeah, this has been said, but actually, you know, she wasn't politically naive. She's actually perfectly within her rights, because I'll ask Shu to confirm, so I haven't got it wrong, but actually, they were basically advised by people whose ideas of China were extremely out of date. It must have been blatantly obvious that in a country which was nicknamed Red China, red was hardly going to be a colour that would be politically offensive in that sense. Pat Nixon, I think, in a sense, is, I mean, again, an interesting character, and in a sense is given more form by the opera than perhaps she had in real life. People felt she was a little neglected, perhaps, by Nixon in her later years. But, of course, there's that great line, "I come from a poor family, trivial things are not for me." And that, I think, sums up the way in which she's made part of the enterprise that Nixon is given in the opera. I mean, when Alice Goodman was asked to write the libretto, she said, "Yes, but I write it as a heroic opera, not as a satire." And one of the things that, well, for many people would seem very surprising is that watching it makes you feel very sympathetic to all of the main characters, and that includes both of the Nixons.
How was Pat Nixon received in China?
I think it's, looking back, people, of course, saw her as the human face of the whole visit. She went to visit a commune where she, you know, played with children. She, you know, had the good time in the opera. But I think, or the Forbidden City, of course, but I think it was Madame Mao, Jiang Qing, I think, who took the center stage. Because we were talking about in the second act, where they went to see the opera, actually produced by Mao's wife, these revolutionary women who were born from a very poor family, liberated and joined the communists, and then fought for the whole country. And that was the opera, a dozen operas. We, I think, not just I, but the whole of the Chinese had to watch for about 20 years, nothing else to watch but that. But I think also, I think people perhaps were unfair to Jiang Qing. And she was the scapegoat, of course, after Mao's death, for have plotted against a lot of things, for opposed Zhou Enlai. But I think she was a very, very wise woman, probably frustrated because Mao had so many women, and Jiang Qing wasn't even allowed to see him. And this ambitious woman, beautiful, clever, what did she do? She started to have her own power politics. And that she turned into producing this opera, which a lot of people say, okay, it was boring, it's revolutionary. But when you look at it, it was beautiful.
So do you think she's been dealt a poor hand in history? Do you think she deserves to be reconsidered?
You know, there is only one woman in our history which was made an emperor. That was it. Or empress in the 7th century, the most open cosmopolitan age in Chinese history. And she died, she had the tomb, grand, but with nothing on the stone study. She said, "Man would write history. I would leave posterity to judge." I think perhaps it's too early to judge Jiang Qing when we had no, you know, not enough evidence anyway.
So how does the ballet in the opera, in John Adams' opera, epitomize the role of women and the role of arts in China? I mean, Mao talked about the arts as being the cogs and screws of the revolutionary machine.
Absolutely. I think when you, whatever one says about a communist rule in China, I think one thing is certain. The status of women has just, you know, improved dramatically. It would be the difference of heaven and hell. I think, you know, for my grandma's generation with bound feet, for mom's generation who was simply, you know, part of the male society, and for my generation, which we are called half the sky. I think that huge transformation in barely 50 years is extraordinary. But talking about art, I think this is where communism does use art tremendously successful as a propaganda skill. And that, whether the opera is, you know, was watched by 100 million people, but the message was delivered and just sort of instilled in people's mind through all kinds of art.
Now, Nixon famously described the visit as the week that changed the world. Did it?
Well, it was certainly the week that helped him to get re-elected, although that probably wasn't in doubt at that point. I think, taking account for the fact that Nixon, rather like Mao, loved a bit of bombast, there's a lot of truth to it. Because if you look back from 40 years distance, which is what it is now, to that week and a little bit more than that, in February 1972, and all the other things that were going on around at that time, the Vietnam War, disturbances in Latin America, riots within America itself, there's an awful lot of bleakness there. This is one of the few events that, for good or ill, seems to stand the test of time. By going to China, by beginning the process that opened up full diplomatic relations between the world's most populous country and the world's most powerful and richest country, a dynamic was started that essentially has led us to where we are today, a world in which that very poor communist country is now technically still under a communist government, but in fact one of the most capitalist countries in the world in terms of its economy. It's got the second largest economy in the world, and it's in all of our lives in a way that was unimaginable even a few years ago. You can't put all of that down to Nixon, but it is fair to give a certain amount of credit to the fact that he opened those doors that have then led us to the economic and geopolitical world that we see before us today. This very morning, after all, Hillary Clinton is in Beijing and talking to the Chinese very much as an equal partner, or at least equal interlocutor. And that also is the legacy of February 1972.
And how is the legacy seen in China?
I think it is a crucial. This is one of the turning points in history. It ended China's isolation. It's the importance of this country was recognized. But I think above all, for ordinary Chinese people, it planted the seeds of the open door policy, the reform that have transformed China, that have made the world look anew at China. I think that is, the point where it all happened.
For you, life must have changed dramatically in China. You still spend many months a year there. How has it evolved in your lifetime?
I think it's it is unbelievable, because when I look back, it's barely 40 years ago, and that was the country when China was on the verge of starvation, when Nixon visited China, when all the universities, cities were shut down, and when, you look and there was, nothing there for people to live for, except for this ideology, communism. And we have come a long way. Of course, China is now recognized as one of the big players on the international stage. But we have a long way to go. Not the least that 150 million Chinese still live in poverty. I think, but it is in the right direction.
Thank you. Incidentally, I asked John Adams yesterday about his opinion of Nixon, and he said he hated him. But on the other hand, he was pretty grateful to him too. A big thank you to my guests, Rana Mitter and Sun Shuyan.
Louise Fryer was chairing that Proms Plus discussion over at the Royal College of Music, and it was produced by Ruth Thompson. This is BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and in the second interval in this evening's performance of Nixon in China, Adrian Morby will be examining the way tastes in subject matter for operatic plots have changed over the centuries, leading to the kind of docu-opera that the team of composer John Adams, librettist Alice Goodman and director Peter Sellers pioneered with Nixon in China back in 1987. Well, here's the story so far. The American president has landed in Peking, as Beijing still was in the early 70s. Nixon and Kissinger have had an audience with Chairman Mao, and we've witnessed the euphoria surrounding the official welcoming banquet. The opera's second act is where the action shifts really from documentary to allegory. The First Lady, Pat Nixon, sets off on her own on an official sightseeing trip in snowbound Peking. The First Lady is given a relentlessly positive and upbeat view of modern China. She's presented with a glass elephant, which brings back memories. And next comes the Evergreen People's Commune, where the guides distract her from the painful sight of the People's Clinic, persuading her to pose with the pigs for the photographers. She meets some children and reminisces about her days as a teacher. Then there's a visit to the Summer Palace, where Pat hopes for peace, progress and reconciliation, and a muted trumpet underpins her homily on the unknown soldier rising from his tomb. The final destination, the Ming Tombs, where ancient Chinese emperors were laid to rest. And another elephant, this time a sandstone sculpture in the warm glow of the evening sun. But the words of the chorus hint at the terrors and deprivation of the Cultural Revolution, and as the sun sinks, it's time to return to the official limousine. Well, Mrs. Nixon's homespun simplicity could seem comic, but she actually comes over as a warmly sympathetic character. In fact, every main character is drawn with a degree of sympathy, except perhaps for Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who's depicted as a true villain in the opera's next scene. The formidable Madam Mao, sung by Kathleen Kim, the former actress at Jiangqing, makes her first appearance. She's presiding over the performance the Nixons really were taken to see on their visit in 1972, The Red Detachment of Women. It was one of only two ballets officially sanctioned during the Cultural Revolution, part of Madam Mao's concept of a new genre of people's art. Suddenly, Pat Nixon notices that the brutal overseer who's beating a peasant's daughter on stage bears a startling resemblance to Henry Kissinger. In fact, for the purposes of the opera, it is him. And as the score increases in savagery at this point, whipping up rain, wind and a storm, the Nixons go to the aid of the heroine, enraging Madam Mao as she struggles to bring her propaganda piece to a suitable conclusion. Cue the jaunty entry of the Red Women's Militia and the chorus brandishing copies of Mao's Little Red Book, the famous volume of the chairman's quotations. Madam Mao's will has been reimposed, and counter-revolutionary elements are silenced. Well, despite the limitations of performing Nixon in China at the Royal Albert Hall, you might fairly describe it as semi-staged. Chinese and American flags hang in various places. We've had the flags waved. Images of Mao and Nixon are being projected onto the screen that wraps around the top edge of the stage, and the cast is acting its socks off where it can. There's dancing to come as well. We had a little bit at the banquet. And the presidential aircraft really did make an entrance, albeit on a scale a little different to that imagined by the opera's creators, I suspect. A model of the very aircraft, Spirit of 76, passed from hand to hand amongst the members of the chorus, and finally across to President Nixon, who handed it to Zhou Enlai as a sort of gift with the American entourage. You might have heard the delighted reaction to that in the hall and to the appearance of the Nixons. Robert Orth, eerily like former President Nixon, sort of jowly, long of jaw, hair slicked back and brilliantined, and the suit spot on as well. And he's got the gestures and that very toothy grin, absolutely off to a tee. Well, here comes composer John Adams to conduct the cast, the BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Orchestra, in the second act of Nixon in China. And in a snowbound Peking, Pat Nixon is about to embark on her official tour of the city. Thank you.
treat each day like Christmas. I treat each day, I treat each day like Christmas.
Look down, look down.
Expression
I started in, man upon hen. She was so hot, I was hot put to be polite.
Thank you. master play. She'll get up afterwards, you'll see. Easy there, hon.
Whip her to death!
This is the fate of all who set small against great. Leave it to rot.
Thank you. a crack. Oh, Dick, you're sobbing!
Thank you.
I breathe, I flatter myself, I know my man. The scenic one on the face on the coin, you see what I mean. The empire builder, the man with his shoulder against the roulette wheel. He stands like a stone wall, and stinks, 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 stinks of success. I'm here to liaise with the backroom boys who know how to live. And me, I contrive to catch a few crumbs. The ringleader's name's the gist of their schemes. Loose change.
Dear friend, something for you. You're talking like a real pro.
Oh!
Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, one of the most enduring symbols of China's cultural revolution, has just been waved at us here in the Royal Albert Hall by Madam Mao, the rest of the cast and chorus at the end of the second act of Nixon in China, the opera by John Adams. They're still standing there, holding the Little Red Book aloft as Adams turns to face the audience from the podium. And in Alice Goodman's imaginative libretto, we've just witnessed facts colliding with fiction as Henry Kissinger and Pat and Richard Nixon become entangled with Madame Mao's staging of the official ballet, The Red Detachment of Women. Madame Mao, Jiang Cheng, is sung by Kathleen Kim, Chairman Mao by Alan Oke, Premier Zhou Enlai by Gerald Finley, President Nixon by Robert Orth, and the First Lady Pat Nixon by Jessica Rivera, all in scarlet, with James Rutherford as Henry Kissinger morphing into the ballet's brutal tyrant, and the three women of Stephanie Marshall, Louise Poole, and Susan Platts, who also portray Mao's three secretaries. Well, the opera's third act enters a different world, the private musings of the characters on both sides of the political and cultural fence, on the Americans' last night in Peking. The act where, in the original production, Chairman Mao climbs out of his own portrait on the wall and dances with his wife. Meanwhile, in this second interval, 20 minutes takes us from Neptune to Nixon, as writer and opera journalist Adrian Morby looks at the way in which the type of subject matter considered suitable for operatic treatment has changed so radically over the centuries.
Opera today seems to be about anything. In the 25 years since John Adams gave us a singing Richard Nixon in China, we've had operas about Death Row, Courtly Love, Internet Murder, Sophie's Choice, and Mice and Men. Looking backwards, it all seems much simpler. Consumptive courtesans, noblemen seeking to free the kind-hearted peasants, gods misbehaving, and castratos winning great military battles. That's what operas were supposed to be about. Back right at the beginning in Renaissance Italy, the subject matter of opera seemed much simpler. Apollo descended, or Neptune rose with his trident, and every man on stage was heroic, even if he sang like a Bee Gees. I asked Dr. Suzanne Aston, fellow of Jesus College, Oxford, if I'm right and opera was just all gods and goddesses at first.
In the first decades of opera, when it was court-focused in Florence, in Mantua and in Rome, the interest was primarily in gods and mythological characters who could actually help justify this new all-sung genre. So there was a focus on musical characters, characters who sang, and who not only sang but demonstrated the power of song. Characters like Orpheus, Apollo, Orion. Otherwise audiences would say, as they did, what on earth are we doing having this all-sung genre? People don't sing to one another, they talk to one another.
So what was happening with the ordinary people at this time?
In the 1630s, when opera was introduced to Venice, Venice immediately took to the genre and incorporated comedy into it, as well as retaining the supernatural elements and the heroic, and indeed bolstering the heroic elements. It introduced the comic characters. So we have this shift in genre in the 1630s, away from gods, or an emphasis on gods and mythological characters, towards an emphasis on classical heroes and the comic people of the everyday, particularly drawn from commedia dell'arte. Now, those comic scenes remain absolutely crucial to opera throughout the 17th century, the rest of the 17th century, until you get to the 1690s, when a reforming spirit comes upon opera from various quarters, but is particularly strongly felt in Venice, which by that stage is the home, the centre of opera. And Venetian reformers decide that opera has become too obsessed with novelty and with effect for effect's sake, withdrawing the audiences without thinking about the purposes of theatre. And they want to purge the supernatural, purge the comic, and focus on the heroic, the tragic, the serious. So that's what they do. They create a genre that comes to be called opera seria, because its characters are only heroic and only serious. And the comic characters disappear for a short time.
The 18th century, that gloriously baroque and deeply serious era in opera, was exemplified by George Frederick Handel. Handel still had some room for amorous gods, but most of his operas focus on generals, crusaders, kings of ancient Scotland and queens of Castile, all of them facing big challenges and making big Baroque gestures. How typical was he?
His choice is very typical. His emphasis on predominantly serious subject matter is absolutely standard for the period. These were stories about classical heroes, about Julius Caesar, about Tamburlaine the Great, about historical figures from the very early part of Roman Italian histories, because opera seria plots weren't really about history. Opera seria plots were about the classic conflict between love and honour, love and duty. So what would happen within an opera plot is it would take as a springboard some historical event like Alexander the Great's battle with the Emperor Porus, for example, and from that it would build a whole web of love relationships, various love triangles, which would all have to be resolved by the end of the opera when the heroic character or characters would decide to renounce their love interest in favour of their duty, or renounce their interest in someone else's wife or someone else's fiancé in favour of returning to the marital bed and to their duty as a leader. So it was all about portraying for the aristocracy and to the aristocracy of the 18th century this sense of duty.
So while this was going on with the aristocrats, were the ordinary people the subject matter of opera at all?
Opera buffa continued to feature people from everyday life, albeit stereotypes. It was also primarily about love triangles, love relationships, or about servant characters who dupe their masters or fool their masters in some way. So it wasn't necessarily a sort of day-to-day representation of everyday life, but it did represent people who were clearly not heroes, who were ordinary people in their comic romantic entanglements. But there are other trends to look at as well. There's the intermingling of the serious and the comic in a way that allows the comic to challenge serious authority, the authority of aristocratic characters. That intermingling, that mixing of characters, assumed political overtones as well as comic overtones increasingly in the 1780s and 1790s. We see that perhaps most notably in Mozart, in Figaro, where it's very clear not only through the musical genres used but also through the plot that in some ways Figaro and Susanna are challenging particularly the Count's authority.
That authority was about to be challenged to a greater extent than Mozart's contemporaries could ever have imagined. The 19th century dawned early. In France, it began in 1787, and its turbulence spread rapidly until Europe emerged unrecognisable by 1815, despite everything the Congress of Vienna did to try and put the 19th century genie back in its bottle. History had become a malleable, contemporary thing, ever-changing, rather than the stuff of myths and Caesars. I asked the music historian, Roderick Swanston, what effect this had on the subject matter of opera.
I suppose the first change comes when composers, intellectuals, people generally, culture moved away from thinking that the residue of knowledge came from the classical world, the Mediterranean world, and moved northwards towards romantic Scotland, or even in Donizetti's case to Liverpool, where he wrote an opera called Emilia di Liverpool. Bit by bit, you notice in the 19th century, they started becoming interested in people who were sort of ordinary people. I think Rob Roy is a sort of ordinary person, but made extraordinary by circumstances. And I think that's part of a kind of Napoleonic shift. So people thought that an ordinary person, like Napoleon, could rise to the top by heroism or some virtue or some ability. And this certainly reflected what composers thought of themselves. If Haydn was a servant, even though privately he might have been incredibly vain, Beethoven no longer thought of himself as a servant, and Wagner certainly didn't.
What about freedom as a subject matter? It does seem to become more important in the 19th century.
Freedom is an interesting topic because in one sense, freedom could be applied to all sorts of stories. The freedom represented by, say, Beethoven's Fidelio, which is obviously tied in with the idea of liberté coming out of the French Revolution. And this shows an ordinary woman freeing her husband. What you do find, which you do not find in the 18th century and the 17th century, is peoples being freed. The idea of, for instance, in Verdi's Nabucco, of people being freed, or whatever freedom is in Boris Godunov, where in a sense the people are never free from themselves. They might be free of one tyrant, but the message at the end of at least most of the versions of Boris Godunov is that they are simply free to repeat the same mistakes again. So it's a rather grim view of history.
One of the most curious aspects of 19th century opera is the growth of interest across Italy in operas set in England, especially Tudor England. Donizetti wrote about Elisabetta at the Castello di Kenilworth and about her mother, Anna Bolena. He also wrote about Maria Stuarda and about Elisabetta's favourite, Roberto Devereux. Rossini wrote about Elisabetta, the Regina d'Inghilterra, and Bellini about English Puritans. Two men who inspired a lot of history operas in 19th century Europe were Sir Walter Scott and Friedrich Schiller. I asked Roderick Swanston about how they packaged up history to make it attractive to composers.
Sir Walter Scott is a very interesting example of how people treated an author. I suppose what he gave composers a good deal to do with is, A, they could still portray characters. They could still portray lovelorn characters like Lucia de Lammermoor, based again on a Scott novel. But they could also incorporate into that, as for instance William Tell by Rossini, with lots of local colour. So I suppose in one sense what Walter Scott did for them was to give a repertoire of characters that they could draw on and of a good deal of kind of daring do, lots and lots of running around and battle scenes, whereas classical tragedy, which had been based on ancient tragedy, didn't want to include battle scenes on the stage. I think the other thing about it is that Scott, taking a particular view of history, started including real historical characters like Quentin Durward. And as a result of that, along with people like Schiller, the German playwright on which many operas are based, introduced a confrontation between Mary, Queen of Scots, and Queen Elizabeth I, a confrontation which never took place, but which they felt ought to have taken place. And that's certainly true of when you set things like Ivanhoe and others in the Crusades. They didn't bother to check the facts of the Crusades. They simply became heroic characters against good, against evil, and these other elements.
So where do we place Wagner and his unusual choice of subject matter in all this?
Interestingly, when Wagner went to Paris, he set a historical story in the shape of Rienzi. And this was certainly to cash in on, to put it in its worst way, on the kind of thing which had been popular in Paris with Les Huguenots and the Prophète and so on, real stories even out of history, even though the foreground characters or the way they behaved certainly wasn't necessarily historically accurate. But Wagner, I think, began to feel that you couldn't tell the more general things about greed, about love, about renunciation and redemption and so on through the means of real characters. And he was inspired in this, really, by both Hegel, but in particular by Schopenhauer. These people were, in a sense, puppets of the various human conditions and the human outcomes of actions and so on. And so what he particularly became interested in doing is to present them in mythological terms. And in this, of course, he harks back, ironically, to Aristotle, who makes a distinction between history and between myth. And a great thing about myth is that it's grander than history, it's bigger than history. It's not untrue, but it's more than true. It's universally true. So you can't live next to Tristan and Isolde, but what they suffer is part of the human condition.
And it's also true that at the same time as opera was moving away from history to the rediscovery of myth, it also began, certainly towards the end of the 19th century, to make serious efforts towards putting real life on stage.
I suppose one of the most interesting things of the development is away from history towards a documentation of modern life. Could you actually put what's happening in the world today on the stage and make it realistic? And I suppose in some ways the trailblazing opera for these is La Traviata. One of the things that Verdi was most worried about, or his censors and others, is how close to the bone it really was. It's still a big issue in La Traviata. She may be consumptive, but what she partly suffers from is the snobbery of her future father-in-law to save the face of his daughter, who wants to marry socio-economic group one, and finds that the son would disgrace that and make that impossible by marrying La Traviata, Violetta. Great thing about that, of course, is that that must have been a contemporary problem of France. It's an exposé of contemporary values. Opera must be able to address contemporary issues. I mean, it certainly does with the relationship of power, of seduction, of betrayal that you find in something like Tosca. Or you find the relation between different cultures you find in Madame Butterfly and so on. Now, I think in all these, it became a way of saying that opera is not irrelevant. It isn't something of a museum subject where you simply have to talk about things in the past and people have to extract from that in the audience what general message they should have. Now we can have opera as a way of interpreting and explaining some contemporary issues.
Are we finally then putting real life as the subject of opera on stage?
We aren't always putting real life on the stage. Sometimes we are. I mean, the options are always open to modern composers. They can set, like Nixon in China, a real story made up of some documentation and so on. On the other hand, you can still have a mythological story. The Minotaur, for instance, of Bert Whistler is still a mythological story, but still raising perennial issues. What opera does best is to extract from the everyday life those general things and charge them with the power of music.
But does this mean that opera can now be about anything? Shirley Apthorpe is a European music critic for the Financial Times who has sat through a lot of 20th and 21st century opera. I asked her if she could see any themes that link the subject matter of modern opera.
I personally can't really see anything that does. If I sit down and think of all the new operas I've seen and operas that are known of in the 20th century, I find them so extraordinarily diverse that it's utterly impossible to detect any one common thread in subject matter, or even any two or three or five common threads. There seem to be almost as many subject matters as there are operas in the 20th century.
And why do you think that is?
I think that the course of history in the 20th century was so violent and so extreme and so fragmented itself that it had an inevitable impact on the artistic output of people writing through those turbulent times. I think in particular, there was hardly any other time when the nature of a political event like the Second World War had such a major impact on the way people thought of art forms. We had Theodore Adorno, the philosopher, saying there can be no poetry after Auschwitz. That was one statement which summed up a lot of the attitude that led to things like the Darmstadt School of Composition, very hardcore modernism in Germany on the one hand, and then completely different reactions in America when many of the composers went on in entirely different directions.
What about the individual? He does seem to rise as a character in 20th century opera, either operas about loners or operas about individuals versus society. Do you think there's a development of the individual as a subject matter for opera?
You can certainly see some composers following that line of thought. Benjamin Britten is an obvious case with Peter Grimes and Billy Budd, Death in Venice. I think the perception of individuals is also something that you could argue is a political consequence. Also in Germany, protagonists want to move quickly away from mass hysteria questions of mass movement towards individuals. I think an interesting case also is Carl Amadeus Hartmann's Simplicius Simplicissimus, which is an opera about a simpleton in time of war. He was setting his opera in the time of the 30 Years' War, but it was clearly a play on the events happening around him during the Second World War. There are many operas about loners, but there are equally many operas about groups, about societies, about events in the 20th century.
If you say that operas can be about as many things as the composers want them to be about, where do we place John Adams and something like Nixon in China in that very wide panoply of subject matter?
I think Nixon in China is an oddity because it's such an overtly political theme, not just an overtly political theme, but a political theme taken out of the day before yesterday's politics. I remember when I first heard the title of the opera, I thought it was a joke. I thought, this can't be real. Has someone really written about something that recent? There are not many operas that try to put such contemporary politics onto the opera stage. I was trying to think of parallels. There was a rather prophetic little opera done in Berlin by the Neue Kölner Oper about Angela Merkel and her squabbles with Stoiber, which actually was created before she became Chancellor of Germany. And that's enjoying quite a comeback recently. Bongani Ndodona in South Africa has written an opera about Winnie Mandela. But on the whole, opera composers tend to strive for a little more distance between themselves and the subject matters of the operas, maybe in search of a more epic or a more arm's length quality.
Maybe it comes down to this. While composers, from Monteverdi to Giuseppe Verdi, were still concerned to give audiences what they wanted, the subject matter of opera reflected the tastes and obsessions of the time in which it was composed. But as operas become less populist, composers have felt free to pursue their own interests, however esoteric. The modern West End musical chooses its subject matter to reflect popular taste. Opera doesn't seem to feel that obligation. Shirley Apthorpe.
I would argue that different composers in different countries feel a completely different kinds of obligation to please their audience or to write works which easily take their audiences with them. I think in America, on the one hand, you have composers like Carlisle Floyd and Giancarlo Menotti, whose operas did and do continue to please audiences. They're easy to follow, they're easy to hear. Other US composers like Philip Glass